this is the Piece of Advice podcast coming to you from the University of Oxford. Today, we're sitting down with Dr. Mehdi to talk about her recent book, Global Norms and Local Action, The Campaigns to End Violence Against Women in Africa. Thank you for coming. Thank you so much for your time. We so appreciate having you. Let's start really broad. Given your wide variety of work on gender-based violence, women and politics, and conflict more generally, what are three core messages that you would like to convey to policymakers?
Well, thank you for the invitation, first of all, Rachel. I'm happy to be chatting with you. So I will focus this on my work on gender-based violence and three things that I've been doing this for about more than 10 years now. And three things that I've learned through my research that I think are very important. One is that specialized mechanisms actually work. So my book that we'll discuss in a bit is about the creation of specialized police stations. And I've done research on this in Liberia and Côte d'Ivoire. And these are both post-conflict countries. And while both of these countries have specialized units, and while they are far from perfect, while they do not work as we'd want them to work, they are a major improvement on what existed before in terms of policing. And so I think it's important to note that specialized mechanisms work, but that they need long-term support from the international community in order to provide the support that women need and in order to ensure that women get access to justice. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I think it's important and I've learned from my work is that we need to have a holistic approach to law enforcement / to addressing gender-based violence. I think in the criminal justice sector, there's a focus on arrest and prosecution, and those are really important, especially for survivors that I've spoken to. But also what I've learned from speaking with survivors is that they need assistance after the court case closes, after it ends, after the person is sent to prison. A lot of them need a great deal of financial support, social support. People lose their jobs because they've decided to pursue prosecution. People are stigmatized in the communities. They want to be relocated. They want career training. And so an important thing I'd like to underline is that when it comes to addressing gender-based violence, it cannot end in the courts or end in the criminal justice system, but that girls and women need support, financial support, social support, psychosocial support, even after cases have ended and everyone else has moved on. And the third thing I want to note is that traditional leaders can play an important role in addressing gender-based violence. Now, this might seem a bit, maybe a tiny bit controversial, because what we hear about traditional leaders when it comes to gender-based violence and when it comes to human rights and women's rights is that they often play a role in reinforcing certain practices, in upholding certain practices that are harmful to women. But what I'm seeing now, and I've recently began a project on women traditional leaders, and what I'm seeing now is that in many communities in Ghana, Liberia, Botswana, South Africa, traditional leaders, especially women traditional leaders, provide a great deal of support and in some cases connect survivors of violence to the criminal justice system. However, because we tend to think of them as people whose actions tend to be in conflict with human rights and women's rights, they're often not brought into the conversation on gender-based violence, and they are not thought of as partners. And I would say that, yes, it is true that you can have traditional leaders whose actions are in many ways harmful. But then what I'm seeing is that when many of them are brought on as partners, they can actually advance the women's rights agenda.
Thank you. That's very interesting. And particularly your last point is something I hadn't thought of before. And I'm sure many policymakers don't think of because of exactly the reasons you outlined. So important to remember that domestic environments are variable, and that we shouldn't sort of treat them all in similar ways or take carry assumptions into the spaces that these kinds of activities are trying to be implemented. Your most recent book looks at how and why international norms on women's rights are implemented within African states. Could you maybe outline what your research involved and what its main findings were?
Yes. So my book, Global Norms and Local Action, The Campaigns and Violence Against Women in Africa, published in 2020, is a study of post-conflict policing in Liberia and Cote d'Ivoire. Specifically, what I study is the implementation of what I term the International Women's Justice Norm. And this is a norm that focuses on holding perpetrators of gender-based violence, especially sexual violence, accountable, bringing them to justice, ensuring that they go through the criminal justice system. And what we've seen since the 90s is that many countries actually in Africa have created specialized mechanisms, including specialized police units. And there are different types of these specialized units. Some of them are made up entirely of women police officers. Some of them have both male and female police officers. Some of them are entire institutions unto themselves. Some of them are embedded within regular police stations. And what my research has tried to understand is why is it that we have variation in how states implement this norm? So why is it that certain countries have basically institutionalized their specialized units, whilst others have not? So I compare Liberia to Cote d'Ivoire. Liberia has 4 specialized units, a specialized police unit, a specialized prosecutorial unit for gender-based violence, and then another specialized unit for sexual and gender-based violence in the Ministry of Justice. It also has a specialized court, criminal court E, that deals exclusively with sexual violence. And then there's Cote d'Ivoire that only has the gender desk. Before the gender desk, they had what they termed focal points. And these were individual police officers who had received some training. And then after that, this was upgraded to gender desks. And these are standalone buildings in which police officers work to address gender-based violence and other crimes. But these countries differ not only in the number of specialized units, but also how they have established their police units. So Liberia, after the Civil War in 2003, they created the specialized units. So there was, on paper, there was an agreement that they were going to create a Women and Children's Protection section. Within a year, this unit had a central directorate that oversaw the operations of all of the other units across the country. Police officers were assigned exclusively to these units, and they worked only on gender-based violence. And within 4 years, there were units across all administrative units or all counties of the country. And then there's Cote d'Ivoire, where a year after the conflict, they did sign an agreement saying they were going to create a specialized unit. However, after 4 years, the specialized unit in the police force did not have a central directorate. Police officers were not assigned exclusively to dealing with gender-based violence. So they worked on gender-based violence, but also on a host of other crimes. And 4 years after, not all units, not all administrative units within the country had a specialized police station. So the question then was, why has this happened? And my answer very simply is that domestic conditions matter and domestic actors matter. So in both countries, there was strong international pressure, and this international pressure was enough to get the government to create on paper these specialized units. within the police force. However, when it came to what I'm calling institutionalization, the formalization of the units, creating a central directorate, ensuring that every region of the country has at least one specialized police station. When it came to that level of implementation, international pressure was not enough. And that is where domestic pressure and domestic actors became important, because in Liberia, there was a great deal of domestic pressure from the women's movement, and they were then able to get the government to prioritize gender-based violence, to prioritize sexual violence in ways that the women's movement in Cote d'Ivoire, because they were not as strong, were not able to do. So in basically that's like a summary of my argument in the book. I also talk about the importance of domestic political and institutional conditions in Liberia that favored the institutionalization of the units. And this included things like having the UN more involved in security sector reform, but also having a woman president who prioritized gender-based violence and who did things like appointing women police officers to senior positions. And these were women police officers who recognized that gender-based violence was an important issue. This is not to say that you need to have a female president in order for you to have favorable conditions, or that you need to have only senior women police officers, but just that having these things, having these actors in place ensured that the institution was more welcoming of the UN's involvement, and therefore the institutionalization of the specialized unit happened much quicker than it did in Cote d'Ivoire. And finally, I think an important question is, why does any of this matter? Why should we care about specialized police units? And that goes back to my comment about my answer to your first question, which is that they actually make a difference, in that when I did go to police stations where in Liberia, I noticed that there was a greater recognition that sexual violence and other forms of gender-based violence were crimes that should be prosecuted. And so this norm, this international women's justice norm, had been was more salient in Liberia than in Cote d'Ivoire. This is not to say that in Cote d'Ivoire there wasn't a recognition that sexual violence was a problem or that it should be prosecuted, but just that police officers in Liberia held this view even more strongly. And once again, I like to say that it doesn't mean that they always enforce the law as they should. It doesn't mean that corruption wasn't a problem. But I did find that there was a major improvement in policing in comparison to the initial post-conflict period.
Very, very interesting. Thank you. And I think your case studies prove the point even more strongly, because Cote d'Ivoire is often considered a much more capable state, much higher levels of education, a lot of the kinds of things that might lead to the reverse kinds of outcomes to the ones that your research provided. So the fact that those domestic conditions really are the things that matter really seems to override some of the other things that you know, might have worked against it. So I think the case studies really, really prove your point, I think, really well. Given these findings, is there something the international community should do differently in its programming in order to better ensure that its values are both institutionalized and enforced at the street level? Your book looks at institutionalization and street level, which I think is really interesting. In other words, given the important role of domestic actors and contexts, is there anything the international community is doing that it should stop doing? Or is there anything the international community should do more of?
Well, yes, I think something that international community can do more of is recognizing that women's rights activists, women's organizations at all levels, grassroots and much more formalized, can be important partners, or are in fact important partners, and that in terms of establishing specialized police units, or not even specialized prosecutorial units, I think it's important for them to be brought on board from the very beginning, and for them to be seen as partners throughout the process. Because what I saw especially in Liberia, was that the women's movement was so active, women's organizations were so active, not only in pressuring the government, but just working, you know, day in and day out with the police, doing things like when women were violated and maybe were a bit worried for valid reasons, worried about going to the police. The women's organizations took the lead in sometimes accompanying a woman to the police station and then, like, holding her hand, supporting her throughout the process. And so they are key actors when it comes to ensuring that women get the justice that they want. And therefore, I think what the international community can do more of is working closely. I mean, when it comes to security sector reform, there's a tendency to focus on the states and the security agencies. And yes, this is really important. But what I've seen is that women's organizations, women's movements are able to hold the state accountable when they're given their support, when they have a voice. And in Cote d'Ivoire, when I spoke with people working in these various women's organizations, something that they kept saying was, well, I do not want to criticize. I'm afraid of criticizing the government. I feel like there are ways in which the police could better support survivors. But, you know, I'm worried that if I speak out, I'll be seen as partisan in one way or the other. And therefore, they just didn't have a voice in the same way. And because the international community had not sufficiently brought them on board as partners in the establishment of the specialized units, they were often on the outside. And so I would say that in creating these specialized units, in establishing them and ensuring that they meet the needs of women, we need, or the international community needs to see and recognize that women's movements and women's organizations are partners in this process.
Really, really, I think, important point. This perhaps just a quick note on the next question, then. This would suggest that there is even, would you suggest that even in contexts where domestic conditions are not as favorable as others, that there is therefore still scope for international organizations to do work? Or given what you've just said, is there an argument to be made that international organizations should really only be doing this kind of work in countries and in contexts where there are strong local organizations, strong women's organizations, the kinds of domestic conditions that make these policies and programs work? Is there a reason to say that they should put more of their resources in those contexts, less in countries where perhaps those women's organizations, that civil society is a bit weaker?
No, because, I mean, the issue is that survivors of violence everywhere need the support, I mean, as much support as they can get. And for that reason, I would say that even in countries where the domestic conditions are not that favorable, the international community needs to devote resources. And part of that would go towards making the domestic conditions a bit more favorable to implementation. So I would say that it's not a matter of either or one or the other, but it might mean that some countries, due to the domestic conditions, need more support than others. But not that some countries should get support and some countries should not. And I'm going back to the example of Cote d'Ivoire. The political conditions within the country made it a bit difficult for women's organizations to speak up. And in fact, the women's movement in Cote d'Ivoire was very politicized in ways that it wasn't politicized in Liberia. And this is one of the things that made the women's movement in Liberia much stronger. But something that could have been done in Cote d'Ivoire was recognizing that this is a very divided political landscape. But what we can do in creating or in establishing these specialized units, we can ensure that in addition to the police, the gendarmerie, the military, we also have women's organizations from all sections, all factions, even if a lot of them are not in any way affiliated with any political faction, and some of them are. But what could have been done was ensuring that they were also at the table and then had a voice. And in some ways were given a bit of power to hold the police accountable when things didn't go as they should have gone.
Great. International women's rights and norms are often painted as incompatible or in competition with African cultural values. And you started out outlining how traditional leaders can actually be important parts of the solution. In your book, you outline a specific challenge of domestic cultures perhaps being more favorable to more conciliatory or mediated forms of managing violence against women, as opposed to more justice-based or punitive measures that are often encouraged by international organizations. What would your response be to those who would argue that indigenous methods to managing violence against women, including those more conciliatory, more mediated responses, are better than the ones backed by international organizations?
There are a few things here. It is true that within a lot of traditional justice systems, the focus is on reconciliation. The focus is on ensuring that the community remains united, and therefore having members of the community being accused and prosecuted and imprisoned might not support this community unity that's seen as very important and is indeed very important. But also, I think it's important to know that cultural values are very much contested and are dynamic, and they are constantly evolving. And so when you speak to people and you ask, so what's the cultural, and even that is, I'm not sure, this like one cultural approach, but when speaking to people from maybe a specific ethnic group and you ask what is the approach to dealing with sexual violence, you might, or other forms of gender-based violence, you might learn that, well, it is one that seeks to bring the parties together and maybe might find the offender, but will not support arrest and prosecution. But I just want to point out that while that might be the case, it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody in that community wants that or shares that or shares the belief or is invested in that value. If you think about it, we're seeing this globally, right? If you think about like what's happening in the US now, and the battles to control what is read in schools and the policies that are being created that in many ways put sexual minorities at a disadvantage, what you are seeing is one group of people saying this is what constitutes American values. But there are many other people who are like, no, that is not what it means to be an American. Those are not American values. So it's a very similar thing. And when I did interviews with often, even with police officers, they will say, well, this is in this culture, in this our tradition, this is how sexual violence is dealt with, and people don't want to involve the police. But then I will speak to survivors of sexual violence, women who were raped, some of them were girls when they were assaulted, and across the board, even those who did not report to the police, or those who initially did not intend to report but reported because someone encouraged them to, all of them said, I want the rapist arrested and prosecuted. And they felt so strongly about it. I had women say, I want him executed. That is how strongly survivors felt. And that is what they wanted. And I spoke to women who, you know, after they reported, the community got involved and the rapist was fined and then was let go. And they were so hurt and felt so insecure, and they wanted to leave their communities because they said, it is not fair that this person has done this horrible thing to me and he's walking around free. And I have to live with it. And so I want to tell you this story because it's something that has stuck with me for years. A young woman I interviewed in Cote d'Ivoire who, Abidjan, and she had been raped and she had nobody to support her. She was, I think, 17 when it happened. And it was late at night and she gets on the bus, goes to the police station, and she wants to file a complaint. And the policeman says, go and come back in the morning. She says, no, I need you to write it down in the book. And then he says, well, you need to pay, which she did not need to pay. So that was very much illegal. And she says, well, I don't have any money. All I have is the bus fare to go home. But she said, I gave him the money and I slept on the steps of the police station until it was daylight, and I walked home. And the rapist family came and threatened her, and they said, you know, he's going to get out and he's going to get you. And she said, I do not care. I want him locked up for what he did to me. And this is a 17-year-old girl without family support. And she pursues this to court. And he's convicted and he's locked up. And she says, I have no regrets. Even though they said he's going to come for me when he comes out, I have no regrets. And I'm just telling you the story because I think it's important when people say that, well, it's not an African value or African values. The fact of the matter is that the very thing we are calling tradition and values are very contested. And there isn't agreement on how these issues should be addressed. So I think that's the first important point I want to make. The second point I want to make is that Africans play a very important role in constructing international norms. And I do write about it in the book. A lot of the advancements that we've seen in gender insecurity, we've seen on issues like UN Security Council Resolution 1325, women's rights activists from across the continent have been behind a lot of these changes that we're seeing, a lot of these advancements in women's rights. And so they are international, but yes, they are also very African. And a lot of the people on the ground who are actively pushing for the creation of these specialized mechanisms are African, and they are participating in the construction of this international norm. And so it's so when we talk about are international norms compatible? The fact is that international norms are also very much African norms. So that complicates the picture a bit more. Yeah, and the third point that I want to make is that I did hint at it when I spoke about the importance of women traditional leaders, that even traditional actors who we think of as people who are in many ways against the formal criminal justice system, increasingly we are seeing that there's a recognition that there are certain types of crimes, especially sexual violence, that they should not be involved in. And so I'm currently working with a team of collaborators, and we're working on women traditional leadership in Liberia, Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, and Botswana. And when we've spoken to women traditional leaders in all of these countries, and something that becomes clear is that they recognize that sexual violence is something that should not be resolved within traditional courts. A lot of them recognize this. And this is not to say that some of them do not go against the law and intervene in these cases, but also a lot of them are encouraging women to go to the police. A lot of them are accompanying women to the police. I was in the Eastern Cape of South Africa two weeks ago working on this. And I mean, I was in communities where there's been a great deal of sexual violence, including against children. And the first person that people call often when there's an attack is the woman chief. They do not call the police, partly because they think that the police will not take them seriously, and that women, the woman chief, is more likely to be listened to by people in the criminal justice system. So she's the first person that they call, and then she then liaises with the police. When I was there, there was a major incident in which a child was raped and murdered. And I attended an event where the traditional leaders, the traditional leadership, invited the police and said, "This is happening in our community and we need you to take action. How can we work together?" So I think the point I'm making is that the very idea of African values and traditional values and norms, these are all things that are contested. African actors play a key role in constructing international norms, and also even people within traditional leadership, a lot of the leadership of traditional institutions are gradually accepting the importance of the criminal justice system when it comes especially to addressing sexual violence. I think that's my answer to that question. It's a long answer, but that's the answer.
It's a very good answer. I really enjoyed the response. And I think the answer to the question is crucial, because I think your whole interview has spoken to the dynamic sometimes you can see in international organizations of a belief in the patriarchal, the inherent patriarchal nature of any non-Western cultures. I think there's often this kind of narrative, and I think it's important to acknowledge exactly the points that you've mentioned: A, the variation; B, the ongoing dynamic nature of indigenous culture or African cultures in this case, but also in other parts of the world, as well as the very important mechanisms within traditional cultures that push for the same kinds of values, that women's rights is not an exclusively Western concept at all, and I think it's just so important to have that understanding and that kind of nuance when we're thinking about looking at gender in Africa and elsewhere. So thank you very much. Is there anything the international community can learn or has already learned from schools of African philosophy or African culture to augment its understanding of women's rights?
Well, yes, I think there are several, many, many things that the international community can learn. One thing I want to talk about, which is relevant to this discussion about gender-based violence, is the need to recognize that there's a connection between the economy, the global economy, and women's everyday experiences of violence. And this is something that African feminist scholars have written about and have spoken about. And in fact, many critical feminist scholars have spoken about this. But there's a tendency when we write about gender-based violence, but when we especially think about the criminal justice system, there's a tendency to to almost disassociate it from the state of the economy globally, and how all of that trickles down and affects people within their homes and affects them when they are walking to school and affects them when they are in their offices. Because if you think about things like trade policies, when you think about things like structural adjustment policies that reduce, you know, state support for people in varied areas, and support that includes economic support. These are things that impact on people's lives. It impacts on the amount of money that they earn. It impacts on what they have in their pockets. It impacts on their ability to take care of their families, to send your children to school, to feed their children. And so you can have global economic turmoil and global economic policies that might favor Western countries, but might not, and often favor African countries. And you have families and individuals who are experiencing this on a daily basis. And then this is contributing to things like widespread unemployment. And there's already research that shows us that things like unemployment are connected to gender-based violence. And specifically that even when it comes to sexual violence, men's inability to perform these very traditional masculine roles can be a contributing factor to issues like sexual violence. But then when we talk about sexual violence within African countries, there's a tendency to jump to things like culture and tradition, but totally ignore the fact that there are global economic forces that often put African countries at a disadvantage and that contribute to household scarcity and poverty, and that create conditions for violence. And this is not to say everybody who's unemployed is going to commit a crime, no. But rather that these economic conditions end up impacting people's lives and creating the conditions that favor violence. But there's a tendency to almost think of this as two very separate things. So we are creating specialized police stations, but we are creating them in the midst of widespread unemployment and poverty. You can arrest as many people as you want, but when the root causes of gender-based violence are not being addressed, you know, you are basically just, you've come up at best with a partial solution to a problem. And to me, that's very important. But also the fact that when I speak to survivors, what they say is, yeah, this person was arrested and is locked up and I'm happy, but I do not have a job. I don't have a way to feed my children. And I wish I had some support. And so there is a very close connection between the economy and people's experiences of violence and survivors' experience of the entire criminal justice process. And I would say that is something that needs to be recognized, and we need to really ask ourselves, are we looking for full solutions or partial solutions or temporary solutions? Because until we seek to address the root causes, at best, we are presenting partial solutions to these problems.
Absolutely. And no better proof of your argument than COVID, which seemed to lead to increases in domestic violence across the world. Everywhere, the sort of economic impact of COVID tended to be connected with levels of higher domestic violence. And so there was discussions around that from very early on in COVID, but indeed in conversations around Africa, the tendency to focus on tradition, culture, etc., those types of arguments is very strong. And I think your reminder to focus on the economic aspects is crucial. So thank you very much for this incredibly deep, interesting, nuanced conversation. I certainly learned a lot about it. And I'm sure our listeners thoroughly enjoyed. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Rachel. Thank you.